1, 2, 3, car! People try to rank these songs.
Talking about ranking the Beatles.
Even though my ranking's wrong.
Talking about ranking the Beatles.
600 million albums sold.
Talking about ranking the Beatles.
Hope this podcast ends before we get old.
Oh, please, God.
It's ranking the Beatles. This is ranking Beatles, baby. Yeah.
I like it.
Thank you.
I'm sorry for singing.
I wrote that.
He made me do it. I didn't want to. Nobody wants to hear me sing.
I think it's time to unleash your debut upon the world as a performer.
Well, it doesn't matter if it's time. It just happened.
We're off to the races. It's pretty much going to be amazing.
I'll be expecting my several million dollar contract within days.
It's on the way. It's on the way from what I've been told. Everybody, welcome.
I'm sorry. Did I say million? I meant billions.
Billions. y'all, welcome to episode 115 of Ranking the Beatles. Hope you're all doing well. My name is Jonathan. Over here to my left, as always, the beautiful Julia. How are you, dear?
I'm good.
Yeah?
I can't stop laughing. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
We were trying to record that song, and every time Jonathan started, JoJo would bark. And it just made me laugh harder and harder every time.
Don't tell them that it was planned. It's supposed to be...
Oh, sorry. You can cut this
part.
No,
it's not. No one thinks that that's off the top of my head. That's not improvisation at all. how are you, my dear? You good?
I'm good.
It's a big week. It's Thanksgiving week here in the States.
Hooray!
For all of you Yanks who celebrate Thanksgiving, hope you're all having a lovely week. For those of you who don't celebrate Thanksgiving, we're thankful for all of you.
Aw, that was sweet.
Who listened to our goofy little show.
Mm-hmm.
It does mean the world to us that... you all continue to tune in after 3 years of this nonsense and still enjoy it. So thank you. And those of you who are new to the game, welcome. Hope you're enjoying it too. Lots going on, man. Looking forward to today's episode. Before we do that, though, I do have what our friend Sam Wiles would call a bit of housekeeping to do. There's something I do want to tell you all about that's very cool coming up in a couple of weeks. My band, The Walrus, which, as you can guess, is a Beatles cover band, is playing a show here in New Orleans December 2nd called 60 Years of 63. It's celebrating the anniversary of the Please Please Me album with the Beatles, all the singles from that year. And we're going to be playing, if not both albums in their entirety, plus the singles, like the lion's share of all that material, as well as songs from the remainder of the Beatles catalog, maybe even Now and Then is in discussion. We've had requests for it. But we've had a lot of people ask who don't live here in New Orleans, obviously, how they can catch The Walrus, because we don't really tour a ton. We do some, but we have not done a bunch yet. But we're going to be live streaming this show. So if you're interested in watching, you can go to walrusnola.bandcamp.com and get yourself a ticket. It's $10, but you can also pay more if you feel so inclined to do that. And get yourself a ticket, and we will send you a link the evening of the show. And even if you don't watch it in real time, it'll be there afterwards. So you can, if you're in the UK and 8 p.m. our time is, 4 a.m. your time, something like that, when you wake up, it could still be there for you. But if you want to tune in and check that out, it's going to be really fun. We're really excited about it. And it's our first time live streaming. And we're not doing just like, it's not just an iPhone that Julie is holding. Like,
oh, please no. Don't make me work. Yeah. Please let me have fun.
Yeah.
No, they've actually hired someone to do it.
Yes, it's like a multi-camera thing. It should be very cool. We're very, very excited about it. So if you're into it, it's walrusnola.bandcamp.com to get yourself a ticket. And enjoy your boy and the walrus from the comfort of your couch or your kitchen or wherever you choose to watch the show and enjoy it. So, yeah, that's all. But let's talk about this week's show, shall we, my love?
Sure.
Let's do it. Our guest this week is a writer and producer who spent the early part of her career in radio, interviewing musicians and producing long-form radio specials. She was the writer for Dick Clark's weekly radio countdown show and has gone on to become a television and film promo writer, producer, casting director, and location manager. Through her work in radio, she found herself as an inadvertent part of history as she interviewed John Lennon on December 8th, 1980, in what would be his final interview. She's got a book coming out in December about her career and that fateful evening that she spent with John and Yoko called Confessions of a Rock and Roll Name Dropper. Y'all, please welcome to the show, Lori Kay. All right, Lori, welcome to Ranking the Beatles. How are you today?
Thank you. I'm doing great.
Good. So
glad. How are you?
We're wonderful. I'm so glad that we could finally connect after exchanging emails back and forth for a while. So thanks for making some time to chat with us today. Congrats on the new book coming out December 8th, but kind of early-ish if you pre-ordered, apparently.
Absolutely. You can get it sent out now.
That's awesome. How long has the book been in the works for you?
Well, let's see. My interview with John Lennon was 43 years ago. Right. So I would say that's a good estimation.
For sure. When did you decide to kind of start focusing on it and turning not just the interview, but your story into this particular book?
Well, I'd always considered doing that because the interview not only affected my life, but my life affected the interview, how I reacted to John and Yoko and related to them both. So it was a major part of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the interview, you know, has always been such an interesting one because, and we'll talk about it a little more as we go on. He seems so at peace and excited about the future, you know, especially as I'm looking through the way you describe it in the book, he seems so anticipatory about what's coming up and so open to the future. I can't imagine, you know, what it was like for you, you know, in the aftermath of all that. But before we kind of get to that, I do kind of want to rewind a little bit and start at the beginning. You know, for you, you know, to work in rock radio in the 70s at that time, I would have to assume to kind of go down that path, the music bug probably hit you pretty early. What's kind of the origin for you in terms of getting into that world?
The best explanation for that is actually the title of my book, which is Confessions of a Rock and Roll Name Dropper, My Life Leading Up to John Lennon's Last Interview, because it's my memoir, the story of my early rock radio related life and career, wrapped around what tragically turned out to be Lennon's last day on the planet, which was December 8th, 1980, 43 years ago, which is also when I co-conducted the RKO radio interview with him and Yoko at the Dakota mere hours before he was shot and killed. And my book features details and quotes from that interview, of course, plus many of my other interviews, including everyone from former Fab Four members George Harrison and Paul McCartney to Beatles producer George Martin. That was a terrific interview.
Oh, wow.
To every one of my favorites, from David Bowie and Mick Jagger to the Ramones and Talking Heads. You know, I could go on and on for years and years. I did great interviews, but I started as a newscaster, actually, as a news editor in the news department at KFRC in San Francisco as an intern. And I ended up dropping out of college. I was in the journalism department at UC Berkeley in order to take a full-time job as the news editor, which I did. And after just a couple of days on the job, I had already been notified that everybody considered me extremely talented in terms of news writing and interviewing, all that sort of thing. So I was asked to write the RKO Presents the Beatles, which was the longest Beatles special ever done in the United States for radio. And it was 14 hours. Wow. And it took about a year and a half to put together. I wrote and co-produced it. And it was amazing. And then it was eventually elongated to 17 hours. And they let us change the title when it was syndicated to the title that I'd come up with when I first started writing it, which was The Beatles from Liverpool to Legend. And
that's a great title. Still I love it.
Yeah. That's fantastic. You know, even further back for that, as a kid, you know, what kind of, you know, what was the impact that music had on you? Like, what were you into as a kid? Were you a huge Beatles fan as a kid, or were you into something else?
I was a kid raised by a dysfunctional family from very early on, as described in my book. And as a toddler, I basically related more to my transistor radio than to my mother, single mother, and even my grandparents. And I slept every night with the transistor in my arms in bed and the earplugs in my ears, listening to the radio, everything at the time from Little Richard to eventually the Beach Boys and then the Beatles. That was 1962. All of a sudden I'd be listening to the Beatles, and I did for years and years and years. You know, it was just all of my favorite songs, starting with Love Me Do and taking me all the way to Let It Be. It was just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, you work your way into radio. I have minimal radio experience because I worked in college radio for a year and absolutely loved it. Because, you know, we would get kind of like, you know, the bands that were coming through the college scene, and you'd get to interview them. And for me at 18, that was, you know, the coolest thing. You know, you're doing this kind of at like the, like, you know, the heart of rock of the time of, like, you know, the period of real rock and roll. You know, who were some of the more notable interviews that you had? I know you mentioned obviously other Beatles, you know, David Bowie, Mick Jagger. Like, what were a couple that really like stick out to you?
Ramones.
Yeah.
Not only because I was totally getting into punk rock back then. It was 77, and they were my absolute favorite. They just thrilled me. And of course, the sad thing is that all four members are passed away now. But at the time, it was amazing to talk to them. It was one of their very first West Coast interviews, and they were thrilled to be at the station, KFRC, and they were excited because they had been into the Beatles and they had been into all the old rock groups as well, which really kind of surprised me. Yeah. So that was a wonderful interview. And also Talking Heads, which was right around the same time, and loved talking to them.
Yeah. Now, the interviews you did with George and Paul, how would you what time period were those? I know Paul was like 79. Was that right?
Correct. And George was before that. He was the first. He was late in 78. So, yeah, the interview with George was a phoner. And it was right after his marriage to Olivia, which had been just, you know, mere short time after the birth of their son, Danny, which was very exciting. He loved the idea of not going on the road, but staying home and taking care of the baby. That's what he wanted to do. So it was wonderful to hear that. And George was amazing. And not only was I interviewing him for the expanded version of our RKO Beatles special, but also because I was writing a show called Top 100 of the 70s, and George had a song, of course, that was in that. And so I got to talk to him about that. And it was just a wonderful interview. And we actually talked at the end of it about getting together in person and doing an in-person interview, which unfortunately never was able to happen. But shortly after that, about just several months, was when I got to go to London to interview Paul McCartney with Dave Sholin, the RKO music director, and Ron Hummel, our producer engineer. And that was amazing. It was Paul and Linda McCartney and their latest lineup of Wings. And I had never been to England before, so that was thrilling. And just talking to them and thinking in the back of my mind, oh my God, this is a man that I screamed in front of when I saw him at Dodger Stadium as a little kid. And when I saw him in the movies, I screamed. And, you know, it was just when he kissed me at the end of the interview, I was ready to faint.
Yeah.
Do you have that like internal monologue of just like, be cool, be cool, be very cool, keep it chill, like try to be normal.
But I still look at the picture of me and Paul and Linda and my heart just starts beating like crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it seems like he's being really open in that interview, like open and honest about like the ups and downs of his and Linda's relationship and like just kind of being more human, I guess, than like he gets credit for sometimes where he, you know, admittedly sometimes he'll kind of, you know, give you like the glossed over view of things. But it seems like he's being a bit more open with you in that interview.
Absolutely. And to be honest, the thing is, every Beatle that I talk to, George, Paul, John, they were all so honest. They were all so open and they were all so damn funny.
Yeah.
They made me laugh like crazy. I got to ask them personal questions and get personal answers. And the honesty, it was just wonderful.
Mm. Now, how did the John interview come about?
Well, that's a very good question, because I've heard a rumor that since John and Yoko were only going to do one radio interview following the release of Double Fantasy, that they didn't really know who it was they wanted to speak to, and that John ended up asking Paul, do you have any recommendations? Because Paul had been putting out so many albums over the years, you know, while John hadn't. And that Paul, since we talked to him a year and a half before, said, oh, the RKO radio team. I don't know if that rumor is true, but right. I like to think it is. Paul and Linda had such a great time that he wanted to recommend us. And then the interview was set up with Bert Keen from Warner Brothers Geffen Records, who was with us, and Dave Sholin, who's extremely well-respected RKO executive and KFRC music director, and then Ron Hummel, our producer, engineer again, and me. It was great. It was, the four of us were just so thrilled and so happy. And of course, afterwards, so very tragic.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
It just has been hard ever since then. Every time we talk to each other, you can tell that we're still feeling that sadness. But the interview itself was fun and wonderful.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I was kind of wondering, and I don't want to, excuse me, I don't want to give away a ton of what's in the book, you know, because the way you write about the conversation with them, with John and Yoko, is really, really nice. And you do feel a sense of being in the room with the three of you, or with the group of you, I should say. So I don't want to give that away. I don't want to go too much into what we all know happened later that evening. But one thing I wanted to ask was, from the time that you spent with them, like, what kind of surprise, was there anything that surprised you or that you walked away from that interview thinking like, wow, that was really interesting, or I didn't know that, or I didn't expect that, or that was special, or something like that?
So many surprises. I can't even tell you. One of them was, we had been told from the beginning, don't ask about the Beatles. Don't talk about John's past. Don't bring it up. We're talking about what they've just released and what's going on with their lives now. And so it was amazing to hear John bring up the Beatles,
yeah,
and have him talk about getting together with Paul. That was great. Another big surprise about the interview was one story I've always loved is the story of how John and Yoko met and got together. And I did, when he started talking about it, I did bring it up. And he not just told us the story, he told us in details. He told us about their first date 2 years after meeting. He told us about making love the morning of their first date as the sun was coming up. It was beautiful to hear. And another wonderful thing that surprised me about the interview was that, being raised by a dysfunctional family, I had always felt insulted rather than validated. And sitting with John and Yoko, especially sitting next to John on the love seat, He validated me. He complimented me. And when he liked a question that I asked or a comment that I made or a reaction that I had to one of his comments, he would take his glasses, he would push them down his nose, look over them and stare at me with his eyes and say, "Yes, love, exactly. That's it." You know, and I've never felt so validated in my entire life, to be very honest.
Oh, wow. That's so wonderful.
Gosh.
It's wild to think that, like, someone of the stature and of John Lennon, who doesn't have to be kind to anyone, who doesn't have to see anyone, does.
Yeah.
Like, it's like so nice to hear that, you know, you hear so many stories about, you know, the rough parts of his personality and his life, but, like, deep down, it seems like he was just a good person trying to do his best. And, you know, we're all human and sometimes we mess up, but, you know, that's like a really kind thing to hear. That's so wonderful. I love that.
He was so wonderful. And so was Yoko. I liked them both. I felt like I'd made friends for life. Aww. And I felt like so much in common with each of them. And we all made plans to get together in a couple of weeks when John and Yoko were going to be in San Francisco, the guys and I and them, we were all going to get together for dinner at Yoko's favorite Japanese restaurant. And it just was so exciting. I was just anticipating it like crazy. And of course it never happened.
Yeah. Oh, have you had the opportunity to speak with Yoko since then?
No, I haven't. And to be very honest, I'm not surprised, because if anybody reminds her of the most tragic day of her life, it's those of us who were at that interview.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. My goodness. Well, I like I said previously, you know, I can't quite fathom the aftermath of all that and what that must have been like for you. And I know it's written about in the book. And, you know, I want to thank you for sharing that with us, you know, with readers and fans who, you know, are so invested in this story. And, you know, I'm sure it's taken a lot of emotional lifting on your end to kind of relive all that and put that pen to paper for all that. So I want to say thank you for doing that. And, you know, it's really a fantastic record to have.
Thank you. It was hard to write it and remember how tragic I felt and the guilt that had been sitting on my head and shoulders for so many years, decades, and still does, to be very honest. But I'm really glad to have written the book, because I feel like now I get to share my story, not just of the John and Yoko interview, but of my life as it played such a major part in it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, time has gone on and you've moved into different worlds, you know, with your work in television and production and things like that. And how are you still, you know, do you still find yourself to be a huge Beatles fan? Like, where do they exist for you in 2023?
Well, the release of their latest song has been nothing less than thrilling.
Right.
That's here. And I still listen to so many old albums and songs, and I don't think anybody could ever not be a Beatles fan anymore. It's not something that you give up. And to be honest, I still listen to almost all of the bands and artists that I listened to starting, you know, as an elementary school student. But the Beatles are very special because of their huge popularity and my ability to have met up with them, almost all of them, unfortunately not Ringo, but everybody else. And it's just played a major part in my life and still does.
Yeah. Ringo, give Laurie a call. Why hasn't Ringo reached out? Come on. Well,
it just never happened. It just, for some reason, that interview was never booked.
Yeah.
I've always felt bad about that. Like, I'm missing something great in my life.
Right. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Well, it'd be amazing if that could happen, or if you could connect with them in some way. If anybody knows someone that can connect Laurie with Ringo, let's do that. We got to make that connection happen.
Ringo, I know you're listening. Give Laurie a call.
Well, you know, the the lovely thing about the Beatles is, you know, even in spite of the tragedy within the story, there exists this beautiful kind of core of everything, which is all this amazing, wonderful, beautiful music that they've given us. And I'm really excited about the song we're talking about today, because it's, even though I have it ranked at number 100 out of 223, it's a real favorite of mine. So I think if we're all game for it, let's go ahead and turn our attention to our song of the week. Friends, coming in this week at number 100 is I Should Have Known Better. In mid-January 1964, the Beatles embarked on their first shows outside of Britain, a several-week residency at the Olympia Theatre in Paris, where they were slated to play 18 shows in 3 weeks. In addition to these three shows, they were also under the deadline to compose six new songs for use in their upcoming first feature film, which was set to begin filming in March, as well as two songs for other artists. So John and Paul, in what appears to be one of their first "We're Stars and We Can Get What We Want" sort of ask, requested that a piano be installed in the room they were sharing at the Hotel George V so they could work when not performing. Now, as an aside, during this stay, despite all the work that they'd have to do, they would end up finding some time to enjoy themselves, as this is where they're staying when they get the telegram that "I Want to Hold Your Hand" has earned them their first number one record in America, which they then celebrate with a lavish dinner and drinks, and of course, a celebratory pillow fight captured by photographer Henry Benson. Now, during this residency, Paul acquired a copy of the freewheeling Bob Dylan album, which by all accounts had a major impact on the Beatles. Both John and George are on record in interviews as saying the album was pretty much the only thing they listened to during those weeks in France. Now, for John, it had a major impact. He was enamored by the folk aesthetic musically, especially with Dylan's use of the harmonica, and visually with Dylan's fashion sense, especially his wearing of the fisherman's cap, which is something John had been a fan of wearing also. The lyrical influence wouldn't really hit him for a few months until the band actually spent time with Dylan, who challenged John to write more autobiographical lyrics. Now, it's not entirely clear as to whether or not I Should Have Known Better, which was written primarily by John, was written during this Paris stay or during the almost immediately following trip to America, though with how compact their schedule was on that trip, Paris would make more sense. But once the band returned to London, they immediately were in EMI Studio 2 on February 25th recording songs for the upcoming film, and in the afternoon session on the first day, I Should Have Known Better was one of the songs they started working on. They'd previously worked that day on new songs And I Love Her, You Can't Do That, and finished some overdubs on Can't Buy Me Love, which they'd started recording while they were in Paris. After some rehearsal and three takes, the band decided to wrap for the day and came back the following afternoon to devote the entire session to the song. The band charged through 19 takes of I Should Have Known Better, most of them breaking down somewhere in the bridge or because John wasn't able to get enough breath between the harmonica and the vocal. Eventually, on what was considered take 22, with John on just rhythm guitar and vocal, Paul on bass, George on his new Rickenbacker 12-string, and Ringo on drums, they capture a satisfactory take. Following this, John double-tracks his vocal and then adds his harmonica part. Now, coincidentally, before I Want to Hold Your Hand, Capitol had turned down the opportunity to release the Beatles' first few singles due to the presence of harmonica on all of the songs. Producer Dave Dexter, whose job it was to listen to British EMI releases and see if Capitol could do anything with them, believed the harmonica was something that really only worked in blues and wasn't suitable for pop music. So there's a great bit of irony in the fact that Capitol then chose the harmonica-led I Should Have Known Better to be the B-side for the U.S. single For a Hard Day's Night, which was released in July of 1964. It was also featured on the American soundtrack for the album, which was released in June by United Artists as part of their film distribution deal, and was released everywhere else on the Hard Day's Night album, which is now the one considered the canonical release. It didn't receive a stereo release in the U.S. until 1970, when it was included on the U.S. Capitol album Hey Jude, a compilation of tracks throughout the band's catalog previously unavailable in the U.S. market, spearheaded by then-Beatles manager Alan Klein. And the song was only performed live by the band only for a short time during their October-November British tour of 64, as well as in a few BBC sessions. So,
goodness, that's a lot of facts.
A lot of facts.
About one song.
So why do I why do I have I Should Have Known Better at number 100? This song actually holds a really special spot for me. I think I've mentioned this before. This is the first Beatles song I can ever remember hearing, and I remember it all quite vividly. I was sitting in the waiting room of an orthodontist's office while my sister was getting her braces worked on. Dr. Jack Clotworthy was his name. He would be my orthodontist, too. I spent a lot of time in that waiting room. I was sitting in a chair on the left side of the waiting room, and over the speakers in the waiting room, the song came on, and there was just something that absolutely hit me when I heard it. I think it may have been the first time I heard a harmonica in a song that wasn't a blues song that my parents were listening to or something that I heard somewhere out and around New Orleans. But it just, something about it just took me. I absolutely love how John's vocal on here just kind of jumps out of the track and almost interrupts the harmonica line and kind of takes everything over. There's just something about the tone of his voice in this period that's just always been the John voice for me. It's rough and it's ragged in all the right places, and it's just got so much emotion and range, but it's still really just a rock and roll voice. George's 12-string plays a wonderful role in this song, in that he basically just plays the vocal melody for the solo, but that sound just cuts through, and it has that chiming, jangly tone that you think of when you think of a 12-string guitar. In some ways, you know, that plus the harmonica kind of make this the cliche, like the classic Beatles 64 song, because it just kind of hits all the check boxes for what a Beatles song should be in 1964. I also think it's really interesting that the song has no chorus. The hook is really in the harmonica part, and yet every element of this song is completely singable. I've always been a big, big fan of this song. I think it's just a classic Beatles song. It's a big favorite of mine. So that's my two cents. Lori, I throw it to you. What do you think about I Should Have Known Better?
Well, I have to tell you, A Hard Day's Night is still one of my favorite movies of all time.
Yes.
I remember seeing it as a kid with girlfriends for the very first time in a theater, and everybody in the theater, mostly teenage girls, was just screaming, so you could barely hear it. So we sat there for two more showings of it that afternoon and finally got to see the whole thing. And I loved that movie. I loved the music in it, especially John Lennon songs, which were Tell Me Why and I Should Have Known Better. And the thing about I Should Have Known Better is, yes, John did write it and he did sing it and he did play harmonica. But the funny thing, of course, was in the movie, you see Paul lip syncing as though he's singing it as well, which always struck me as humorous. But I like Paul. So, you know, if he wants to be funny, that's fine, too. I loved having it as a single on the B-side of Hard Day's Night, also one of my favorites. And it's just the actual recording of that song was just great. I really liked it. And 1964 was a great year for me in terms of Beatles music in general, because, believe it or not, I really loved the German versions of songs that they sang. Lieb dich and Komm gib mir deine Hand. And that's the reason why later in junior high and high school and even in college, I studied German as my language, because I was relating to the Beatles. So I dig them.
That's great.
That's so funny.
You'll be very unhappy to know that those are my least two favorite songs.
I understand.
I'm sorry.
It's just
that's the beautiful thing is there's no right or wrong answer. Everyone's entitled to have whatever they want from this catalog.
Yep.
But yeah, you're right about just the sound of this song is just so good. you know, the production is so clear and clean, and it just, they sound, you know, everything about it sounds great. The guitars sound great. The vocals are great. You know, just the whole production is a winner on this one for me.
And not only that, but the lyrics are amazing, because just the title of the song, I Should Have Known Better, is something that I repeat in my brain to myself on a daily basis. Practically.
Yeah.
Why did you do that? You should have known better. I should have known better. Yeah. You know, and so I say that all the time. And I love the song. I love the lyrics.
Yeah. Yeah. Julia, what do you think about this one, my dear?
First off, I have a question. They lived in a hotel in Paris for 3 weeks and they shared a room?
They shared rooms throughout their touring years.
What?
At the peak of their success, it was still two to a room.
That is bonkers. Mm-hmm. There's absolutely no way I would share. I don't even think I would share a hotel room with you for 3 weeks. And I love you, but like normally we're in our house with like multiple rooms. Like right. I can just go to a different room. You don't have that.
This
at
is
a
why
hotel.
They got a divorce in
1970. That's fair. Oh my gosh, I cannot imagine sharing a hotel room with someone for 3 weeks. That is bonkers. Okay. Sorry, that was like, you're reading that, and I was like, goo? So finally, a song with a harmonica that doesn't make me wince. This is fantastic. And I think that goes to what Lori was saying about how it's like such a good recording. Mm-hmm. Like it's not like the harmonica isn't super loud in the mix. It's like a good tone to it, I guess, is the word I want to say. Like it's not that sort of shrill sometimes that we get.
Lori, as backstory, every song that we've discussed so far that has a harmonica in it, Julia has absolutely hated the harmonica. So I've been dying to know how she was going to feel about this one.
No, I like this one. It's like, it's a good tone. Like it's nice. It's pleasant. It doesn't make me go like, it doesn't make me like put my finger in my ear. I think it's pretty impressive that he stretched the word mine into like 7 syllables. Mm-hmm. I was like, wow, okay, we're dragging it out there. I like it. Yeah. That's impressive. I like it. Yeah, I like this song. I think it's just like a perfect 100, like for the Beatles.
Right.
Because, you know, I guess, is it like graded on a scale, you could say, because most of the stuff they did, almost everything they did is so good that like even if this is your middle of the road song, it's still so good. And I feel like we keep saying this in these like middle of the pack songs.
Yeah.
But yeah, like graded on a curve, it's a really good song. It's not great because we know what's to come.
Sure. Yeah.
So yeah, I feel good about where you put it.
Yeah.
I like it right in the middle of the pack.
And I think for 1964, this is probably a pretty sophisticated bit of pop music, especially in the way that you're talking about stretching the syllables of words out in ways that I think are really interesting. Because you get, you know, when John comes in with I, he holds that for, it's got to be 6-7 seconds.
Yeah.
You know, and then you get things where a lot of other times where he's doing kind of I or my I and things like that. And I think that's really interesting. That's just like not it creates an easy hook, but it's not like an obvious kind of gimmick.
It's fun
thing.
To sing along to.
Yes, it's also super fun to sing along to. And I think partially that's why, like, as a kid, I was like, what is that?
This is
like,
fun. Yeah. I like this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I always picture them playing cards in a train car, like in the movie with this song, you know? But yeah, I think this is just, it's a great tune. I love it. So yeah, out of 223 songs, would this seem reasonable at number 100? I don't know. What do you think?
I say yes.
Yes?
Yeah, I'm good with it.
Lori, if you were going to rank all the Beatles songs...
Lori's like, they're all number one. I love them all. They're perfect.
I was about to say I would have a lot of trouble putting them in an order from one to whatever the bottom one was, because I love so many of them and think about them all the time that it would be really hard for me to rank them.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, think about getting to like the top 50. Like, what do you even do?
I'll tell you in a couple years.
You did it, but I didn't do it because I don't think I can.
Yeah.
But it's just like, yeah, it's bonkers.
Yeah.
There's so much good.
And it's not only because I love almost every single one of the songs, but it's because every single one of the songs plays a major part in my life. I can remember it for the first time. I can remember what it meant to me, who it reminds me of, what I was doing at the time. So it's important music, all of it.
Yeah. And I'm, you know, it's, as I was reading, you know, kind of doing my fact checking and research on this, I didn't put this in the notes because it seemed nerdy, but you were so wowed by the number of facts. there's a moment in the harmonica part in the beginning where it's playing and then like you hear like he kind of takes a breath. And then there's another mix of it that they use in the movie where he doesn't take the breath. And it like, so it plays all the way through. And the first time I heard that, it kind of threw me for a loop because it was like, wait, I'm used to hearing this and now it's this. And there's like 12 different mixes of this song, like, that are out there. There's so many different versions. It's very strange.
Yeah.
There's a lot of mixes, but
it's interesting when you know a song, like you've heard a song so many times, you know it so well, like in your head, that one little change, like a breath, and you're like, something's missing. Something is wrong.
Yeah. And that's a lot of the, that's a lot of the conversation happening right now with the Red and Blue album remixes, because they're remixes of these songs that have been, you know, around for years. They're brand new mixes, and you're, there are things that people have never heard before that just because they were buried in the mix, you know, guitar parts you've never been able to tell were there. So it's definitely making everyone's ears kind of jump around. Like today it was like, wow, there's bongos in A Hard Day's Night, like really fast bongos. Who knew? Yeah.
Surprise.
Yeah. Well, I think we've ranked one, Laurie. I think we did it. Before we wrap for the day, do you have time for a couple of rapid fire questions?
Sure.
Cool.
I'll do my best.
They're usually never rapid. Yeah, it's fine.
Super easy. Start out with the hardest one. Your favorite Beatles song. And it can be of all time or it can be just today if you don't have a definite favorite.
Ooh, that's a hard question. Yeah. My favorite Beatles song. Just going back in my life and thinking about the song that meant so much to me as I was growing up, I would have to say Paperback Writer.
Ooh.
Because it's what I became.
Yes.
I love it. Such a good choice.
Yes. That's awesome. Your least favorite Beatles song. Do you have a least favorite?
A least favorite Beatles song. Not really. I don't really think of that. But to add to Paperback Writer, what I will say is in my book, every chapter is named after a song, some of them Beatles songs, some of them individual Fab Four member songs, some of them other bands and other artists that have meant something to me songs. But of course, one of the chapters in my book is called Paperback Writer / Every Day I Write the Book, the Elvis Costello song.
Yep.
So that defines my life as it is right now. So that's why I would choose Paperback Writer as number one at this moment.
I love it. I love it.
That's a good choice.
Do you have a favorite Beatles album?
Well, I love A Hard Day's Night. I love Rubber Soul. I love Abbey Road. I love Rubber I love Sgt. Pepper's. I mean, there's really nothing that I don't love, to be very honest, because it all means something to me.
Sure. Sure. Who's your favorite Beatle?
I don't know if I have a favorite Beatle, to be honest. I really liked all of them. I loved Paul because the first time I saw him, I thought, oh, he's so incredibly good looking. I liked John because he just impressed me as somebody who was an amazing musician and an artist and also good looking. And then, of course, when he wrote his book, that impressed me as well. And George Harrison extremely impressed me because of his creativity with India and the sitar and Ravi Shankar, that's something that always just knocked me out about him. And Ringo, I thought, was hysterical. He was so funny and he was such a good drummer. And I liked them all. I never really picked a favorite. And especially after interviewing them all, or three of the four, it made it even harder. I mean, sure, I'm sad about John Lennon obviously passing and George Harrison passing. But thank God Paul McCartney is still alive and doing well and was so impressive. And I love them all.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a totally acceptable answer.
Yeah.
Our last one is your favorite memory in which the Beatles play a part. And it can be anything from obviously meeting and talking to any of the Beatles. So pretty great.
Yep.
You know, it could be the first time you heard or saw the Beatles or something like that, seeing them in concert, something like that.
Well, the first time I saw the Beatles was on the Ed Sullivan Show. And that to me still jumps out in my brain because it was so incredibly exciting. I'd heard these guys, and yes, I'd seen pictures, but it still didn't dawn on me how incredibly exciting they were to look at, how popular they were, how the audience would go crazy. And that just rings in my head still. And that's an amazing time for me. I didn't expect to ever see them in concert. I was invited by a girlfriend whose birthday it was when I was in elementary school. Her mother bought like 3 or 4 tickets for her friends to take us all to see them at Dodger Stadium. And even though we sat up way in the highest row and the shouting and screaming was not only so loud, but everybody was jumping up and down so you could barely see the stage, that was still an amazing moment, just thinking about where I was, even if I couldn't hear them or see them. And then, of course, getting to meet up with them was amazing. Even George Harrison on the phone, that was just so cool. I felt like I had just made a new friend. And then with Paul and Linda, that was incredible. And John and Yoko, that was incredible. And I, you know, unfortunately, as I mentioned, never got to meet up with Ringo. But who knows, maybe that will happen someday. And at least I can say I've seen him live in concert.
So yeah, that's close enough. Well, this has been super fun. So Confessions of a Rock and Roll Name Dropper is the book. Where can everybody pick it up? Where can they follow along with you and all everything you have going on?
Well, actually, the full title of the book is Confessions of a Rock and Roll Name Dropper, My Life Leading Up to John Lennon's Last Interview. And people can get that book online everywhere, from Amazon to my publisher's website to Barnes & Noble. Just about every bookstore in the country pretty much has it online to order. They've had it for pre-orders for months now, and now you can order it and get it delivered. And also, with any luck, I'll be doing a lot more book signing events all over the country. I have one coming up on December 8th here in Los Angeles. I'm very excited about at Book Soup on December 8th, lovely, which is exactly the 43rd anniversary. So with any luck, after that, I'll be heading out to all the cities I've lived in, especially New Orleans being one of them.
Nice.
San Francisco, Seattle, Berkeley, Santa Cruz, New York, you know, Texas, I'd like to go to too, Florida. It would just be great to be able to be everywhere I could.
Yeah.
Including Omaha, Nebraska, which wasn't my favorite city to live in, but I love to go there because I still know people who are in radio there, and would love to meet up with them and be able to sign my book for them.
Yeah,
awesome. That's fantastic. Do you have a website where you're listing all where you will be listing your upcoming dates?
Absolutely. The book's website is confessionsofarockandrollnamedropper.com.
Excellent.
And it's got all kinds of segments, not only with all the podcasts I've been on practically, but live reading of the first chapter of my book and the events coming up. And it will have all the articles and reviews. It's already got comments on it It's already got comments in it from people who've read the advanced copies and fortunately liked it a lot. So hopefully that will continue.
Excellent. Well, congratulations. I'm really, really excited for you. And thank you so much for taking some time to chat with us this evening. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. And I'm just curious, have you had a chance to read the book yet?
So I started, I mentioned today, I haven't gotten to read it in its entirety, but I have kind of thumbed through, and I really wanted to, in preparation for this talk, get to where you talk, like, get to the time with John, and I kind of found my way through Paul and George there with that as well. So I've read like the last, I don't know, 30 or 40 pages, maybe a little bit more than that. But I've really enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to going back to the beginning now and jumping all the way through it.
Great. You'll get more about my life. Or yes. As I like to say, sex and drugs and rock and roll.
Yes.
Definitely a big part of my book.
Awesome. Lori Kay, everybody. What a story. My goodness. Man, highly recommend check out that book, Confessions of a Rock and Roll Name Dropper. Really, really interesting story that she has. So yeah, friends, what do y'all think about I Should Have Known Better? That sweet little jam from A Hard Day's Night at number 100. Baby, we're at 100.
We did it.
That means we're out of the triple digits after this episode.
Oh, I can't wait.
We're getting there. I promise you. We'll wrap it up one day.
One
I promise.
Day.
One day we'll get you to the finish line.
Oh boy.
So what do y'all think, friends? Are we too high? Are we too low? Or just like Baby Bear's porridge, are we?
Just right.
I was hoping you were gonna say it while you were yawning just now.
Oh, that'd sorry. Really
let us know wherever you're following us on social media. If you're looking for us on Facebook, you can find us there at
Ranking the Beatles.
If you're looking for us on Instagram, you can find us at
Ranking the Beatles.
And if you're looking for us on Twitter, you can find us at
Ranking Beatles.
That is correct.
I got it right.
You did it. You nailed it.
Yes.
Check out rankingthebeatles.com for all your RTB official needs, including a Rank Your Own Beatles poster, t-shirts, sweatshirts, stickers, I don't know, whatever else is up there. There's a ton of stuff. Tell a friend what we're doing if you're enjoying the show. Leave a 5-star or whatever the most stars you can leave review on your podcast provider of choice. And yeah, that's it, man.
That's it.
Feeling good?
Wrap it up.
We're done, baby. We will see you guys next week with number 99, baby.
Woo-woo!
Yeah, we're working our way. We're ranking them Beatles. We'll see you next week with a brand new episode. I'm Jonathan.
This is Off the Rails. I'm Julia.
See you next time. Adios.
Bye, y'all.